Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to the Liverpool Playhouse. Please welcome a man who's worried that he won't outlive Shane McGowan. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello, Liverpool. Oh, yeah, you're much better than last week's audience. Robbie. Hey. Hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Liverpool Slayhouse Theatre podcast. Yeah, I'm going to murder you all later. It's going to be quite the podcast. Got to get some numbers up, got to get the downloads up. Though I was on the Magical Mystery bus tour today. Amazing. None of the Beatles were even on the bus. I was completely... There wasn't a single one. Not even anyone dressed like Ringo. The driver called it Rahalastapa. Anyway, so there we go. Some more Liverpool facts. That, this is for the people at home more than you people in the room, because, of course, you know... Liverpool is home to Britain's largest clock face. That's... Come on, you should be more pleased with that. That's the best thing you have here, the clock face on the Liver building. It's 25 feet in diameter, where the clocks on Queen Elizabeth Tower, which houses the bell, Big Ben. 2 feet smaller in diameter, so well done, Liverpool. You're being... You've got bigger clocks than London here in Liverpool. I said bigger clocks. You are no longer a UNESCO World Heritage Site. That's not... So, well done on losing that. You got it? You went, ah, fuck it, let's knock some of these buildings down. UNESCO will never notice. They notice. The world's... First, I think only surviving all-female sextuplets were born in Liverpool, the Waltons. Do you reckon anyone managed to bang all six of them? They're grown up now. Well, now they're grown up. They're grown up. That was what I was thinking. Also, like, the sextuplet bit, just that puts that in your mind, doesn't it? It's an amazing... There's a one-man show in that, and I've seen a video of them at 30... They're all 5 out of 6. They're good. You just do the other one to complete the set. Any of them in? Let's get started. Now revealed my plan. They may not. I mean, if you do a couple, it's impressive, right? Look. That kind of humour belongs in the 20th century. I do apologise. I'm a very forward-looking man. My guest this week, fantastic guest for you, is actually the cousin of last week's guest. Which I did not know until they got here. And they didn't know for a while. He's, of course, best known, you'll remember him as Mr. Jackson from Still Open All Hours. That's what we're going to talk about him tonight. Will you please welcome the amazing Neil Fitzmaurice, ladies and gentlemen. Neil Fitzmaurice. Hang on, you can see it. Mr. Jackson. It's Mr. Jackson. There was a lot of potential first best known force for you, Neil, because you've done a lot of things. What did you? I never saw Still Open All. I enjoyed Open All Hours. I never saw.
I think the fact that it was still open was still a mistake.
I mean, it sort of sounds title of it.
It was still open during lockdown, I think. You know.
Did people recognise you from Mr. Jackson?
No, they don't.
No.
I don't get stopped in the street with Mr. Jackson. I didn't even know that was his name.
There's a lot.
I didn't even know. I don't know most of the people I've ever played, I'll be honest with you.
Happy times, did you get to meet David Jason?
Oh, yes, I got to meet Sir David.
Yeah,
it was interesting. He was lovely. He was lovely.
Oh, boy, he's fantastic. I've known you for a while. We've worked together in stand-up, and I knew you. I sort of thought, this guy's a stand-up. He does a bit of acting. I've seen him in quite a lot of sitcoms. But, like, you're really... You've been acting for, like, 30 or 40 years and I've been in everything. It's incredible.
Yeah,
I was impressed with you as an actor just from the fact you're in The Office, you're in Peter Kay's Phoenix Nights, and you're in Peep Show, which are probably the three biggest sitcoms of that era, certainly. That's pretty impressive. People might not remember you from The Office. Do you want to tell the people what you're doing?
I'm in the first series of The Office. I'm in the first scene of the first series in The Office. When I got there, because we were writing the second series of Phoenix Nights when I was asked to come and do it.
Right.
And Asher Tarr, the producer, phoned up and said, because I'd already, believe it or not, I'd auditioned to play Gareth.
Okay.
And the other guy did a pretty good job of that. I could have been the difference there, couldn't I? I could have really bombed The Office there. But because I'd got so close to getting Gareth for some bizarre reason, Asher Tarr had phoned up and said, do you want to come and do a bit in the series? And so I was hired in the first episode, and it was the first time anyone had ever seen. Well, Brent hadn't come out then, he was just doing it then. And they shot the first bit over my shoulder, and I was just laughing uncontrollably because he was doing all the vis-a-vis and it was just incredible to watch. So I'm hired in the first episode and then sacked in the last episode, and I have this whole debate about the differences between dwarfs and midgets with him, which went on for ages because he had libs. So
yeah, I often think that about The Office, because like The Office was very nearly not a success, right? It's one of those shows that went out and nobody really noticed it, and then it got repeated, and everyone noticed it, and it's one of those and it's one that I know the controller of the BBC Two didn't like it at the time, and then afterwards claims that it was her idea, basically, as they always do, so it did. Those people who the actors who did get the big roles, it sort of made their careers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, to get that close to being, it is a bit.
Yeah,
you've had a fine career anyway.
Yeah. But if I write a book about myself, it'll be titled something like "Close but No Cigar." Yeah.
But it is it's amazing. And when you on the other side, I've auditioned for sitcoms. I've written sitcoms and then auditioned people, and you often get down to two people. And you kind of think, should toss a coin more, you know. And none of my sitcoms have then gone on to be that successful that they've made anyone's career. But, you know, it's amazing to think that it's on those sort of slight...
I mean, the acting profession is, it's aesthetic and it's there's so many things that go down to chance. And I was asked once, many years ago, to come in and help cast a show. World Productions were doing a show. And they wanted someone to play three sisters. So there were groups of three girls coming in, and I was reading in. I was just reading in for their dad, and it was just a procession of girls all day in threes, and then mixing the threes. and they had photographs of them all, and I was sort of, they broke for lunch, and all these, I was watching all these actors wanting a job, the way I did, the way you're coming in, you're trying to do the right thing, yeah. and you're trying to do, and they had all these, back in the day, Polaroids, you remember them?
Yeah.
And they had Polaroid pictures of all the cast, all these girls, and they were just, they'd forgotten I was in the room, I think, and they were just going, no, 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 right. no, and I was sitting there thinking, oh man, this is what this game is about. No,
it is.
It's horrible. It's a really tough, you know, it's a really tough profession to be in, I think, for them.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. I assumed that you've been trained because you've done so much acting, you've got so much work, and it's a really difficult business to get into. I know this. I've done a little bit of acting, and I hardly ever get any acting parts. And if you go up for them, there's so much competition. But you weren't trained. Tell us how did this start? Because you started young.
I left school. I went to a school in Anfield called Anfield Comprehensive, which was 1,200 boys. It was an all-boys school, and it was not now when you go into school and it's all painted. You know, and they have like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi quotes and inspirational Einstein quotes. And we had like, you know, Stevie O is a grass spray painted on a wall. You know what I mean? That's what we had. And it was just, there was no, you know, I left that school. I mean, I went to a careers meeting and I knew I wanted to be an actor. I'd done drama in school and I just instantly knew that I wanted to be long-term unemployed for the rest of my life. I remember going to a careers meeting, and the guy said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an actor. And he said, oh, what about roofing? He sort of flicked through, couldn't find acting. And I went, what about roofing? So I left school in 85, right in the middle of Thatcher's, you know, this place was earmarked for destruction. You know what I mean? It was the manageable decline. And Liverpool, you know, a lot of my, I mean, it sounds awful. I'm going to try and make it funny, but it's mostly about heroin now. you know, a lot of my mates kind of were just, there wasn't a lot of hope at all. There wasn't a lot. I wanted to do it myself. I wanted to try and make a way of filming in the city. I didn't really want to go to London. I'm very strong family orientated, and I just didn't want to leave my family. I didn't want to leave and go to London. A lot of people have the desire to get out and branch out and, you know, plow their own. I didn't. Yeah. I just wanted to stay at home and have my tea and stuff.
Yeah.
So I did. I never went. So it was a much harder route to get into, you know, local theatre and youth theatre, and then sort of, you know, and then basically what happened was I couldn't get anywhere. So that's when stand up came along.
Yeah.
I think I always had that thing about being a bit of a smart ass, and then I thought I'd try and do stand-up, because I was watching TV one day and everyone on TV, I think it was there was a comedy series, and it was Emma Thompson, Robbie Coltrane and Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry, and they were all Oxbridge kind of, you know,
the
comedians. Cambridge Footlights.
Apart from Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah, but so there was a lot of that link was there of like comedy, and I sort of segued it in my head and said, I wonder if I tried doing stand-up, whether or not everything I've ever done has been to try and advance being an actor. That's...
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's sort of gotten in the way of it because I've never really put 100% into anything else.
But you sort of have to do that. And I think I think a lot of the best, you know, creative people aren't just satisfied with doing one thing. And I think if you're creative, which you clearly, I do a lot of writing and you do, and you know, obviously you do stand-up as well. Acting can sometimes be a little bit too, I mean, A, you're not working a lot of the time. And if you are working, there's still a lot of waiting around. And you either have to be the kind of person who can do something else at the same time or just empty your brain and just sit there until someone says it's time to go on. There's a few of those.
Candy Crush, that's good.
So I think, you know, you're obviously someone with lots of ideas and lots of, you know, and so stand-up was a good... I really thought you were a stand-up who did a bit of acting, so that's, which is the biggest compliment I can give you.
Yeah, I'll take that.
because a lot of, and most people who are actors who try stand-up don't cut the mustard, really, I think, you know, you can tell.
And I guess it's in a way. I mean, I shouldn't be flippant about stand up because it's been very important in my career, really. Yeah. Because it was through stand up that I ended up meeting Peter Kay, and then we ended up doing writing Phoenix Nights and stuff, and the Peter Kay thing. So I can't, you know. I guess sometimes I just feel like I didn't give it enough attention that I should have done because of what it sort of yielded for me, if you like. But that was my route, really. There was no, when you leave school, and I had no kind of, you know, I didn't have any connection to the industry at all.
No.
You know, my dad just wanted us all to be jockeys. He loved to bet, me dad. He was mad. He just, he'd sort of look at us disappointed when we grew. You know what I mean? Because You're too late now. You're too big.
But it is, you know, it's so it is really impressive that to have got. I think especially to have got into the acting world in the way that you have, without, you know, without the connections, without the training, you know, and then to be, you know, to have had this career where you, if you look at your CV online, it's constant. You know, it looks like constant working. I'm sure there've been times when you haven't been working, but actually, it looks like you're, you know,
that's the beauty of writing your own CV online.
But yeah, so the Peter Kay obviously was a really big deal. Was that clear when you, because you wrote for like the Peter Kay thing and did a couple of little parts in it, right? Is that right? Or
yeah, so we met in the final of the New Comedy Awards, the BBC New Comedy Awards, and then Peter got. I'd already won So You Think You're Funny, which is the Channel 4 version. Pete's, you know, even then was an incredible stand-up comic. I mean, the one thing that he just excels in more than anything is just being able to make people laugh. It's extraordinary to watch. And he got a pilot. He got a one-episode commission. And he asked me to help write on it. And off the back of that, he got six... episode deal, and that became the Peter Kay, that Peter Kay thing.
Yeah.
So we were writing on that together, really. Me, Pete, and Dave wrote on that, and then that won a British Comedy Award. So then, but of course, you know, Pete was very much the flagship of it. It was Pete's vehicle and stuff. And then me and Dave were obviously writing it with him. And then he got a commission of a series, and that's where Phoenix Nights came from. Yeah. And Phoenix Nights very much like The Office, sort of. I mean, they put it on it. On a Thursday night at 25 to 11.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can do a show that you love and then you get it commissioned and then you get it made and you think it's all flying and then, you know, the commission and Edsa phones up and says, we've got it slotted on a Thursday night at 25 to 11. And you go, well, lad, you've just killed it. Everything we've just done, all our hard work, it's gone. Who's going to watch? Who's going to spend a Thursday night at 25 to 11? Not even half 10. It wasn't even that specific, you know. But alongside that, I'd had this dream for years of... I mean, Liverpool is such a beautiful city. And I used to drive along the Dock Road and see these... And they're still there now. They had the old sugar factory thing that was like the big dome. I think that's still there now on the Dock Road. And they had these buildings that had the zigzag staircases out the side. You know, like when you... And a lot of the time they shoot New York City and American shots are shot in Liverpool for that very reason. It's the biggest... filmed city outside of London in the country and probably in definitely in this country anyway because of the buildings and the architecture. So I had this idea that I always wanted to do something and try and control it as much as I could and it happened at the same time as a friend of mine wanted to be a producer and he'd been producing plays and stuff and he moved down to London and then we found out in the mid to late 90s that there was a tax exemption thing, a bit of a con basically. So what happened was people were allowed to invest their money into film production. Now, when you do a film, your film budget, if you've got a £1 million film budget, you spend all that £1 million and you don't acquire anything. So there's no tax to pay on it.
Yeah.
You're only taxed on a product. So it only becomes taxable when that film comes out. Because if it doesn't come out, you've only got a canister with a film in it and it doesn't belong to anyone. It's such a weird kind of vague area. They've clamped down on it now, unfortunately. but what happened was there was a tax exemption thing where people were just plowing money into films. And my mate had gone down to like sort of his dream to be a producer. And he called me up and he said, look, I've met these people and they've got access to funds, but I haven't got a product. I haven't got a film script. And I hadn't worked in 10 years as an actor. I hadn't worked at all from 89 to 90 odd. I hadn't worked at all. And he said to me, have you got any ideas? I'm the youngest of four brothers. And two of my brothers owned a gym. We had a gymnasium in Stanley Road in Kirkdale. So I vicariously entered the world of the dark and misty underworld. You know what I mean? Because I used to listen to these conversations of people and some of these people were full on hardcore gangster lunatics, you know what I mean? And then I started just gathering these stories and listening to these stories. And I was always fascinated with writing a story about someone who accidentally became a gangster. It was more like disorganized crime rather than organized crime.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea that they all wear the sharp suits and, you know, I wanted something that was a little bit more truthful and a little bit more about a victim of circumstances. And so I wrote a script. What happened was I put the phone down for me, mate. Now I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and she said, go and write your idea. Just go and write your idea. And I was living in a house in Kensington. For those of you listening, not that Kensington. very much not that Kensington. The people listening to this going, well, he's doing all right for himself, isn't he? No. And I went upstairs and I wrote this. And within 12 months of the phone call, we were on a yacht in Cannes.
Wow.
And it had been made. And but bear in mind, we'd shot this on, we had very little money at all. And everything was, family members helped. And it was extraordinary. We got given these three trucks. We knew these guys who had a truck rental place. And they said, look, we've got three trucks there we're not using. So we used one as a camera truck. We used one as a costume truck and one as a makeup truck. And we had them all parked behind each other when we were on location. But we only had one tax disc. Right? This is a true story. So what we did was we had a kid whose job it was through the entire film. He would sit in the front seat next to the driver. And when the police turned up, which they always would when you were shooting location stuff, when the police turned up and got out and chatted to the driver, his job was to get the tax disc and run it to the next van before the copper got there. And that's what his job was. He was the tax disc boy. And so we couldn't really afford anything, really. We got Bernard Hill in it. Yeah. It was a film called Going Off Big Time. It's on Prime now. It's made a fortune. I've never seen a penny of it.
Really?
Yeah. It's the biggest gangsters are the ones you hand your film to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was, so that was kind of going on weirdly, sort of traversing Phoenix Nights.
And, yeah.
So in fact, Peter was in it. Peter played a part in Going Off Big Time. So, and that's the thing I'll be most proud of, I think, when I finally get my ticket punched, I think, because my family came to it. My family came to the screen, and Samuel L. Jackson came to the screen, for God's sake.
Okay.
It was really bizarre. He came walking down. I was doing a speech before the film started, thanking the producers and thanking all the investors. And this guy came walking down with a Kango cap on. And he had a large popcorn in one hand and a drink in the other. And two blokes flanking him. And I couldn't really see. Like this now, you can't really see. And as I was saying something, he went, go, Fitzy. And I went, oh, that's a bit weird. And then when he sat down, it was fucking Samuel Jackson. And he was doing a film called 50 First Date that he was just in pre-production of. So right. He'd been invited to come and see this. This film, and it was, so that would be my proudest thing.
Yeah, well, and it did well, didn't it? And
it did really well. It got you. You know, independent cinema then was a struggle. Independent cinema now is a nightmare.
Yeah.
Because cinemas are owned by America, the American cinemas chains, and they, when we were doing Going Off Big Time, which was 1999, we made it. I think it was released in 1999, 2000. You had to get a. I think Pete mentioned it last week.
Yes, last week. Yeah. You here last week?
Is that enough? I'm not having this last week.
Was that Samuel L. Jackson?
It might have been him.
Just leave.
He needs to put the Kango back on and all that. You know, you had to have faxes from America to cinemas in this country to let them show trailers and stuff. And now it's even worse because now it's just Star Wars or the Avengers. So independent cinema is such a difficult thing to do, and it's really annoying because there's so many talented people out here who don't get a chance to do it. So Going Off Big Time, getting released at all was incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, for the thing we shot it on, we greenlit the film on £90,000.
Right.
And we shot it on anamorphic, which was Ben Hur. So basically you have this anamorphic film stock and it's 70 millimeter. It's just this incredible. So they shot Ben Hur on it and then they realized it was really expensive and just put it all on a shelf and no one used it. And we went, yeah, we'll have that for nothing. Thank you very much. Well, it just meant that you had to have an anamorphic converter in the cinemas.
Yeah.
To show it, but we got loads of them at them. So we just seated the pants, shot the film, and we were running out of money all the time. And we had this, we had £60,000 that was coming to us from the Del Monte Empire. Do you remember the advert? The man from Del. Give that man an orange. Well, this is the story. So they withdrew their investment a week before we were planning on spending it. So we were the only people in the world the man from Del Monte said no to. that's how we lived with that one particularly. But it was really, you know, we were running out of money. We didn't know if we were ever going to finish the film. So that, I think, will go down, I think, as the biggest thing for pride, for me, sense of pride.
Yeah, but again, Nick, so this is something most people would get that opportunity and go, oh, and fumble it or not do it. So to, you know, again, it's just, you've got something, you've got the drive in you that you knew you didn't want to be a roofer. I had the same thing with my careers advisor. I said I wanted to be a comedian, and he said it's not on the form.
Yeah.
And I think he said you should work in a bank, which was, even I knew that was bullshit. Because I'm like, everyone in my family was a teacher. So I knew if I wasn't going to be a comedian, I was going to be a teacher. So I didn't need a career. So, you know, these guys, you know.
Whatever happened to Banks?
Yeah, but you know, so to do that, and you know, you must have been what in your sort of in your 20s or 30s there. You were young anyway, weren't you, in the 90s?
Yeah, I was 29, yeah, 30, yeah, 29, so, 30. Yeah, so I think with me, it's always been a thing of my drive is being told I can't do it. I think that's probably, if I have any talent at all, it's trying to prove people wrong, I think. And because I came from an area where there was no actors really knocking about, and you were constantly being told no.
Yeah,
I think that was probably, and still does to this day, is probably what drives me. If you tell me, I wrote another film, and we were in some party somewhere, and this film, he was a distributor, and he said, and he was just an arsehole, you know, he was just, I mean, this industry's full of them, he was just an absolute tit. And he said, if I can give you one bit of advice, don't ever put, I'd just written this script, and he said, don't ever put death or somebody's name in the title of a film, because they never work. And I went, Mrs. Robinson. Well, it was called A Graduate, but... Yeah. But I called my film Charlie Knows R.I.P. because I thought, I'm going to put a name and death in it because you said I couldn't. So that's, I think that's what drives me, you know what I mean? It's that thing of like not being able to, being told I can't do it.
Yeah. And then let's talk about Peep Show, because it's like that turns out to be just an amazing... Jeff in Peep Show turns out to be an amazing character, which I presume you get recognised for all the time.
Yeah.
But it's almost like a dream, because it's just a character who comes in every now and again, an episode is brilliant and is completely memorable, and you know it's
yeah. And it was one of them things that again, it was a guy called Ian Morris who went on to write The Inbetweeners and stuff. Yeah. He was a commissioner at Channel 4, and he was a big fan of Phoenix Nights, and they were doing Peep Show, and he called them up and said, "Do you want to come down?" And I actually, believe it or not, read for Superhands.
Really?
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
I really want to be in this alternate universe
where you're like an episode of Pirates of the Caribbean, isn't it? You know as well. I mean? Yeah, it's weird. An episode of Sliders where I made it, you know what I mean? It was weird. I went for, so Matt King obviously was doing Super, and then he went, oh, does this character Jeff? And I started reading it, and I went, do you want my own accent? And they went, yeah. And it's just something about, you know, the Scouse thing and being a bit of a smart ass. And,
yeah.
And it just seemed to connect with it. And I still have more people, weirdly now, more people talk about Peep Show than Phoenix Nights, I think, because Peep Show is generational. I mean, students love Peep Show. It's a big student show, and then they pass it on. And,
yeah, I think so.
You know, and then I think it's took up that mantle of that. So I get loads of photographs where people go, can you just do that? Because it's one of the things at Peep Show.
I think because we were like probably maybe in lockdown or maybe just before lockdown, we rewatched the whole of Peep Show. It's one of those shows that I think you do keep coming back to. It's a very, you know, it's what an amazing show to
so
be a part of.
Yeah, it was. And you never knew at the time, you know, Olivia Colman was in it, for God's sake. Yeah. And you don't know where, and she was amazing then, you know what I mean? You just watch people like that, and oh, there's no surprise that she went to stellar heights because she's just a phenomenal actress. And you watch her doing stuff, you know, you watch her offset when she's just adding stuff to scenes, and she's just extraordinary talent, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and David was exactly the same as Mark Corrigan. He's exactly... It was funny, I don't think he'd ever seen anyone from Liverpool before. I don't think he'd ever... It was just terrifying to him. So he never really got around me at all. He was just sort of, hello. And every now and again, like, he'd be doing like a crossword in the Independent or something in between. And I'd lean over and I'd go, oh, 7 across. I think that's inappropriate. And he'd go, yes. Just astounded that I had an education, you know what I mean? Yes, it is, Neil. Well done. Yes. We had to do a scene once in Peep Show when I'd moved in with Sophie, with Olivia Colman's character. And then we've split up, and I'm packing my stuff out the flat. We had to do this little scene where he turns around to me and he says, I think you better leave, Jeff. And I turn around to him and I go, and I look at him, I go, who's going to fucking make me? Are you going to fucking make me? And we did the rehearsal, and he shit himself. It was unbelievable. He went white, you know, and then he went missing. Right? So they were setting up for the shot, and then I went, where's Dave? And he went, oh, he's gone outside. He fucking crapped himself, because it was such a weird environment. I don't think he'd been north of the Wofford Gap. I mean, by the way, you'd probably sue me because he has, but it just seemed odd. It seemed like I was it fitted that character because I was so different from everyone else in it, you know what I mean? And it was a great show too. It was really a really difficult show to do because the discipline of acting is not to look down the camera lens.
Yes.
And all of Peep Show was looking down the camera lens. So I would find myself looking at the people standing. Because what they would do is when we did the first series, they constructed a harness and it was a camera lens that went right there in the center of your eyes and like a kind of harness that went over your head. So they just sort of moved like that because it was all PO. It was originally called POV, the show, which is point of view, but they changed it to Peep Show. But what happened was when they do like a one take, the person had lifted off and they'd have all marks on their head where this thing had been. So they'd have to wait for that to go to shoot the reverses. So it became totally impractical to do it. So it was just a handheld cameraman over the shoulder. And then you would basically have the person saying lines off. So they would be standing right next to them. But because they're standing right next to it, the discipline as an actor is you would be looking across at them all the time because you didn't want to look down the lens.
Yeah.
But you had to look down the lens. So it was quite a tricky show to do. And when you had stuff that we had a place we all worked in called JLB Credit with the amazing Patterson Joseph who played Johnson. Just an unbelievable actor. Just incredible. And you had like 9 or 10 people sitting at a table. It would take a week to do a scene or two scenes because you had to shoot every single POV.
Right.
So you'd do this thing to death, you know. So it was quite a challenge to shoot, but it was an amazing show to be on and it was amazing to see how it grows and still does. I still get asked to do like Peep Show quizzes.
Yeah.
And these all go around the country and they pack out. There's 1,000 people all shouting, "Jeff, you wanker." This is extraordinary.
I like Jeff. I want him to win.
Well, this is the thing. People always say, "Well, you're so..." I mean, he was voted apparently like the Channel 4's worst, biggest comedy baddie or something, which is great. But for me, it was Mark Corrigan who was the arsehole of that show. I mean, he was the opinionated one who sort of slagged everyone off. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just kind of found him out a bit.
Terrific.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm going to ask you some emergency questions because, you know, people will be upset if they haven't had one from available in the foyer.
Sign them, Richard. Are they available to sign?
I can sign them. Brilliant. I can do whatever. I can do a print of my bollock on them, if you like. We should get some ink. My one bollock.
If you can peel it off your leg.
Yeah, it's true. It's very hot today.
Very hot.
It's very hot today. Let's go down the line. Have you ever seen a ghost? Question number 3, if you're following at home.
No, I haven't. But I was once... I was riding up my street on my Grifter. You remember the Grifter bikes?
Yeah.
Fucking amazing. Mine was silver, beautiful. And I heard a scream come from my house. And it was a house of people I knew, kids that I knocked about with. And I ran in the house. And they'd been doing a Ouija board.
Oh, God, yeah.
So it's a Ouija board-related story.
Yeah.
And the girl whose house it was had punched her fist through a window. And the other people in there were screaming, saying she was pushed.
Oh, All right.
Into the window. So I never saw a ghost, but I was
you were near,
close,
you were
like second cousins to a ghost.
Cycling close.
I nearly, yeah. My grifter got me there too late. Heavy bike.
Yeah, I've just been reading Danny Roberts' book, which is he does some fantastic podcasts about ghosts and stuff. There's some spooky stuff about Ouija boards in there, but if they worked, they'd work all the time, right? They wouldn't just work every now and then.
It's like,
come down.
Do you know what's my theory on ghosts is? If you had the ability as a ghost to be a ghost, you wouldn't fucking blow a pencil, would you? You wouldn't throw a stone in a fucking castle at 4 a.m. so phony goes, what's that? What a fucking waste of time that'd be. You'd be going, yeah, like a fucking lunatic. It just seems like a waste of an opportunity, doesn't it?
It does.
It's like, you know, show me a psychic who's won the lottery.
Yes.
Oh, we can't do that. It's crossing the streets. Oh, you get struck off. No, you don't. You just can't fucking do it.
Maybe they all secretly have done.
Maybe
it.
They do. Maybe they have won it. Yeah, exactly. They, you know,
keep it tight so they can make some more money. We're going right down the line today. I'm asking questions I haven't asked anyone for a long time. Would you rather have a hand made out of ham? Or an armpit that dispenses sun cream? I'm just doing it.
Say it again, sorry.
It's a hand made out of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream.
Wow. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
It's tough. I mean, you've probably been asked it a million times.
I swear to God, I'm sick of it. You'd think I'd have an answer by now, wouldn't you?
So the hand can regrow if you eat it.
So this is...
But so the sun cream is only enough... It'll give you enough for personal use, but you won't be able to sell it. But you can choose the factor, but you can't change the factor.
It's fucking amazing.
Once you've chosen the factor, you've got to stick with it.
You've got to stick with that factor.
Yeah, it's very important that you...
That's amazing.
You can choose the ham.
I'd think it's ham all day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, ham.
Okay. David Mitchell took a long time over this question.
Well, he would, wouldn't he? He probably drew a graph, didn't he, or something? There must have been some sort of... Now, just
David,
wait a second.
David Mitchell's the only person who has asked about the residue that would come off the ham. Wouldn't there be a residue coming off the ham?
Yeah. How do you keep the ham fresh? Would you have to have a little mini fridge?
I think it would just stay fresh. It's just part of your hand. It's just part of your hand. So it would just be like your hand stays fresh, doesn't it, until you die. Or until they chop a bit of it off, don't they? Yeah. It's like it's fresh on the pig until they chop it off.
I mean, that's a question that keeps on giving, that, isn't it?
It is.
I didn't expect that much from that question. It's amazing.
I'll ask that to my kids
when I get home.
I mean, I could talk to you about all your roles, and it's fantastic you've got so many stories about them. I do want to know, and someone has mentioned this particular part, but you've worked with Henry Winkler, a.k.a. The Fonz. Mm. Was it a film?
It was a kids show. So Henry Winkler is dyslexic.
Right.
You didn't know, you think I was going to start with that, did you?
I did not.
And he wrote a series of books about a kid with dyslexia. I think it's called, it's called Hank Zipzer.
Hank Zipzer or something.
Yeah, but his one's, it's an American thing. Okay. And then he brought it over to the UK and I played his dad. I played Hank Zipzer's dad, and Henry Winkler played... Mr. Rock, who was the music teacher.
Okay.
And it was based on when he was a kid, a teacher who sort of helped him go. It was an amazing thing because Henry Winkler, man, we were sitting in the makeup chair one day and the theme tune to Happy Days come on. And it was fucking weird because I didn't know whether to do it. And he just looked up and he went, yeah, no, it's okay. So Monday, Tuesday, Happy Days, Thursday, Friday. I didn't know whether he was going to go, fuck off. But he was such an amazing man.
Yeah.
He was the kind of guy, he sort of like was so L.A. high. But he meant it. It wasn't like he was being... And if he walked past you and didn't let on to you, he would come after you and tap you and say, I'm so sorry, I never let on. He was
an
amazing man. And he told me his story because he had a... You know, he'd go through his phone, he'd go, oh, there's a photograph. And it was a photograph of him and Muhammad Ali and John Lennon. And I'm fucking frantically going through my phone like fucking Floella Benjamin and stuff going, that's not going to fly. That's not going to fucking cut it. You know what I mean? Me and Rod Hull and Emu, that's not going to happen. He's just the coolest man in the world. He was like, and he had this massive high in his career because the Fonz was incredible, you know. And because that's where the saying jumping the shark comes from.
Yeah.
The expression was, it was a storyline in Happy Days where the Fonz jumped over a shark on a motorbike. And basically it's now an acronym, well, it's now a statement for being... ridiculous. So if they say jumping the shark in script writing, it means that you've fucking lost the plot, basically.
Yeah, it's just gone too far.
It's jumping the shark. So he went from that. He had his own... He was the only actor, TV actor, to have a parking space in Paramount Pictures.
Right.
Everyone else were all contracted actors, you know, film actors.
Yeah.
And the moment it finished, he turned up and they just put the barrier down. It was like a literal pulling of the rug. So he had a whole... different thing to contend with. So he's been there and he's And he's an amazing actor, but just more importantly, just a really, really lovely person.
It's good to know, because they aren't all nice. No.
Don't get me started.
I'm trying to get you started. but no, he is, and he's had this resurgence recently as well. He's fantastic in Barry, which is, I don't know if you've seen that, but he's Arrested
Development and stuff like
Arrested
that.
But that's what's interesting. Especially if it's early, you get a part and then it defines you and then you can't do anything else. So like in a way to kind of have memorable roles and things
Absolutely.
That people, you know, but then still be able to go on to the next thing. Because you do serious, you know, all these are comedy we're talking about, you're doing straight acting, you're doing all different fields of acting. And yeah. I think it's, you know, you haven't been typecast.
No, that's a really good thing. It's nice to be known for stuff, but not to be down that road. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to do dramas as well. And, I'm a regular character in Waterloo Road, which is great, man. It's just such a lovely... You know, when I was younger, I wanted to be fucking James Bond, and now I just want to be able to fucking afford chicken nuggets for my kids, you know what I mean? You adapt to what's going on, and this business is even harder now. It's really, really difficult. It's such a hard profession to maintain a career in. So when I look over the stuff, I've had this conversation so many times with people, because I've had it in the past, people go, oh my God, man, how come you're not doing this? And how come you're not doing that? And I'm like, well, you know what? I'm married with four kids, and I have spent pretty much every day of my life with my wife and four kids.
Yeah.
And that to me is, I mean, that sounds corny, and I apologize, but it's true for me. I know loads of actors who have gone really successful, but are divorced and have splintered.
Yep.
Sort of fractured kind of relationships with Ben. And that was never something that ever interested me at all. And we never watch any of my stuff in my house. There's no... Honestly, me and my wife got pissed about a month ago and watched Going Off Big Time, because, as I say, it's on Amazon Prime. And that's probably... I could probably count on both hands the amount of times I've seen that in over 20 years, 25 years, whatever, 30 years. I never watch anything I'm in. It's never mentioned and...
Yeah, well, it's good, but, you know, a lot of people take a long... I mean, I've personally took a long time to get to that point, you know, to realise... Well, you know, I've had my family late, but, you know, you do... Most people take a... Especially in this profession, take a 20 years and then go, oh, actually, you know, even though all the films they're in are about how dads realise that their family are more important than their work, they don't learn that lesson, even though that's what every single film is about. But it was mature of you to realize that at the get go that you wanted to stay here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it's amazing.
Oh, don't get me wrong, I fucked off the first chance I got. No, John. No, it is. It's organic, isn't it? It's one of the things that, you know, I didn't want to go away. I didn't want to do that thing living on my own and down in London for God knows how many years and maybe still living it now. I don't know. I just felt that there was something here for me, keeping me here to. And it did, you know, it did. And Going Off Big Time was that catalyst for that, I think. And then you look at it now and you think, it is tough. And, it, you know, I still struggle for work. I still, you know, I don't... Every now and again, I'll get an offer. But it's they're few and far between. My agent last year... well, my agent's assistant. That didn't take long. why can't I speak to her, though? Well, I had an agent before that, and it was when I did Going Off Big Time, and I was at an awards ceremony, and it was up for four British Independent Film Awards, which is a huge thing for a domestic, you know, film in Liverpool with a tiny budget, and we were up against Billy Elliot, fucker. And I was up for Best Actor, Best Newcomer to screen, and the BIFFA Awards are huge awards, you know, it's the British Independent Film Awards. And that was my moment where I thought, oh my God, if I win this award, I mean, because we'd had two screens in Cannes. We opened in the Cannes Film Festival. We had this old cinema called the Star Cinema, which is a 75-seater cinema, beautiful old cinema.
Yeah.
And we had two screens in a week, and it was self-funded, this. It was all like, you know, you got over there, you tried to promote your film, and no one had heard of us. And our first screen, there was 12 people in there. And in Cannes, it's all buyers. That's all. The only people who go to, your general public aren't allowed in. It's buyers, it's distributors, it's all industry-connected people. And we had 12 people in a 75-seater cinema. And that was on the Sunday. And then we had one more screen on the Thursday, and then we were going home then. And the 12 people spoke to other people, and it's like that. And on the Thursday, we had 125 people trying to get into the cinema, and they were all industry.
Yeah.
And I went, oh my God, this is going to do it. This is going to do it. So you get to them points where you go, this is going to do it, and then it doesn't.
Yeah.
And then we were at the British Independent Film Awards, and it was just me and my brother left in our tuxes. We hadn't won anything, right? Everyone had gone, and it was literally the woman hoovering. Ooh, I shit you not. And we had that much kind of lager left, and I said to Tony, when that lager's gone, this is all over, this is it. This was the last thing of going off big time, really. So as we were finishing it, I just heard this weird how these things happen,
yeah.
Dots connect. I heard this girl shout, I'm going off big time, and I turned around, and it was an actress called Samantha Morton.
Yes.
She's an amazing actress, wow. Oscar-nominated actress.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's from Nottingham, and she had a really troubled childhood,
yeah.
Samantha Morton. And she came over, and she was one of the judges on the panel. And she said, I voted for your film in every category. She said, I loved it.
Oh, wow.
Because she was a Nottingham girl, and this was a Liverpool film, and it sort of sang out to her,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So she said, what are you doing next? And I said, fucking nothing. Finishing this, staying in a shit hotel down the road, probably get a pizza. And she said, well, who's your agent? And I said, I haven't got one. So she tore her cigarette packet and she wrote her agent's number. And she said, I'll speak to her tomorrow and you call her on Monday. So I had this weird conversation with, and when the agent who phoned sort of was so posh, it was incredible. And she said, "Do you have a tape with any of your work on it?" It's like talking to the Queen, you know. So I said, "Well, I said, whereabouts are you based?" And she said, "Piccadilly." I said, "Well, I'm on the ABC cinema around the corner." So my film was fucking on the cinema. So she hired me instantly as an agent. But the problem with that hair as an agent was I'd phone up and I'd go, "Is Nikki there?" And they go, "No, she's in Saint-Tropez with one of her clients." I'm like, "Where are you?" I'm in fucking Kensington, not that one. So it's just getting back. I'm sorry, I've gone off the beaten path. But
no,
I'm just talking about my career now with ups and downs all the time. My agent's assistant called me last year and she said, I've got a couple of jobs for you. One was like, she sent them through and one was like, you know, bloking queue. And I phoned her. I said, look, don't send me any fucking bloking queue. Or before you send it, just fucking name him.
Yeah.
On the email. Just say he's called Dave, but, you know. He's known as bloke. Just don't send me bloke in queue because it makes me feel like, you know, I haven't really gotten anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So she went, well, the other thing is for the Crown. And I went, oh. And she was like, you know, the Crown is such a big job. And I went, yeah, okay. So I looked at it. And what it was this was only last year. They wanted me to go on tape because that's a post-COVID thing now, as most of the world is now, isn't it? Everything is so much easier when they go, can't see you. Why? COVID. It's just a massive excuse for the world not to fucking be in contact with each other anymore, right? Not to.
It can be, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So everything's on tape now. So you have to send tapes all the time, which has its pros and cons, you know what I mean? They wanted me to go on tape to read dialogue, to be a character on a television in the background of the scene that was being shot. They're the moments where you just go, fucking hell. And more importantly, she was suggesting it for me.
Yeah.
When she should have just told them to go and fuck themselves on the phone. So I said, look, don't, I mean, so that's my job. That's how it is. And any kind of work I get, I'm really thankful of getting because sure. You never know when it's going to stop.
Yeah, we know, but that is the life of an actor. And it is a weird. I mean, I went up for a part in Sherlock, which I didn't get, but I had to go. It was when they were still doing auditions live, and I had to go somewhere. And it was literally, and when I saw it, the guy, it was like an effect. So you didn't see the guy's face, and it was just a voice echoing, saying, I think, one or two words. Yeah, why did they get people into audition?
you know what it is? What it basically is the casting director's invoice.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Casting director's will charge 5 days casting.
Yes.
When they could have done it in one day. But they want to do 5 days casting because they'll charge per day. So they'll get 60 people in to read shadowy figure when they could have just got someone in they knew. And that's how this business works. It's so, you know, directors have agents. We all have agents. And it's all part of that thing of like making, spinning the job out. And that's the ridiculous thing about this job. You know?
I guess it is. Look, I want to bring this up, and we don't have to talk about it for too long if you don't want to. But I just, I'm interested to see, like, post this. But you were, what I didn't know until today was you were at Hillsborough and you were like seriously in Hillsborough. And you've talked about this before, and it's like, you know, I'm finding this difficult to talk about, having listened to you talk about it. And so people, if you want to go and see that, I would say, I don't want you to relive that now. But, and this was obviously early on in your life, in your career.
I was 19.
Yeah, what effect do you think that's had on driving you, forwards and making you driven? And, you know, it's such a big thing, right, to experience at 19, and you write about it and talk about it very eloquently, but, you know, it's you saw things that must have been very, very difficult to cope with. Is that part of your life still? Is it part? Is it a thing that drives you? I mean, and have you got any? Obviously, the aftermath of what happened to everyone in Liverpool and everyone who was there was so horrific. As on top of everything else you experienced, is there any closure in what's happened in terms of culpability having been corrupted?
That was a massive thing because it's anyone who's experienced PTSD, it's called survivor guilt.
Yeah,
and that's the hardest thing. You never leave that. I'll have to.
if we don't have to talk about it, if you don't want to talk about it, but it's
no, it's yeah, it's a yeah, it's a, it'll always be a very.
Yeah, okay.
Really difficult.
Yeah, sure. But like, when it's, you know, and I know it's such a big thing in this city, and I know this is going to be hard for everyone else. There's a documentary, right, that people can see if they're interested. And I think but I think the whole experience sort of, again, it helps sum up this city, but it also what the city has been through, right? And I think I hope people will look into it,
it makes you sort of evaluate stuff.
Yeah.
So that's probably why I'm content.
Yeah.
I'm content with the way things are. I'm content with where I am. I'm content with, because there was always that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that it will always be the shadowy figure, but if there's any positive from it at all, it's because you've got that as a yardstick, because you've got that as your low, then pretty much everything else you can handle.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I think that's
the positive aspect of it, I think, is that you can, if things get me down, I go, you know, I have a moment to go, fucking, what am I talking about? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, it puts things in perspective.
It does put things in perspective. And also, it's really interesting that, you know, the comedy is your job, and, you know, and I think comedy has that power, right? That it is a way of not to put things away or, you know, say it didn't happen, but to help cope with that stuff. And I think that's, you know, I think that again must have been an amazing thing for this city, that sense of humor was there and comedy was there and celebration of life was there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for you to get through that and then go, I still want to be an actor and I still want to.
I think it was, that was the whole 89 to 99 sort of period of barren thing. It was probably because of that, because you know you're lost and you don't know what's going on and you're suffering a lot from PTSD and stuff.
Of course.
But I think there's a lot of people here affected by it.
Yeah, of course.
Obviously the city and beyond. But you just sort of use, I guess it's coping mechanisms, isn't it? I think you just, you know, you get the further away from it you go. I think a large part of it was was this idea that everyone thought we were culpable. That was a huge burden for everyone to cope with. And I think the moment that, you know, that was sort of turned around, and the spirit of the city is remarkable. I know it sounds very cliched, but it is an incredible city, and it's an incredible, I've always said this about Liverpool, is you could, if you needed someone to back you up, it wouldn't really matter what your issue was. If you bumped into someone from Liverpool, they would just go, come on then.
Yeah.
And it's just part of that. It's part of that city culture of like, go on, what's up? Well, why are they? Well, all right, then fuck it, I'm with you. And it's an amazing source of pride to me to come from a place where they don't believe in division. You know, it's a very inclusive city. In that respect, I think when people I just love that sense of honour that they have, you know, where they just go, you know what, fuck it, I'm standing with you on that. And it is a remarkable place, and, you know, It was, and because I think it was very much victimized because of Hillsborough and because of how easy it is to set up, you know, a narrative that the entire country believes, and lo and behold, is it, you know, we're living through a narrative now.
Yes,
we're living through a right wing Tory narrative that ruined the career of a socialist MP, and brought in a right wing fucking Tory government who are raping and pillaging this fucking country, and it's because of right wing media outlets that perpetuate this nonsense. And that's, it's exactly the same thing as Hillsborough was. It was a meeting between governments and between the media to say, right, let's redirect this narrative because we are culpable, it's so much easier to say that they were. And that's how that was born. And it was instantly born, and it was believed for 30 years and still is believed by some people. Yeah. Let's be honest, even fucking idiots in this world who still will not look at the evidence and not look at the truth and just go, ah, fuck it, because it's easier to say you're a murderer or you know. But this whole Brexit and fucking business we're in now is the same. It's no one's learned from it. I mean, I think we're worse now. I think we're so much of an apathetic country now. I think so much people look up from their screens and they go, oh, that's terrible, and then they look back down, and I think it's awful what's going on at the moment.
That's true. Well, I think you're exactly right, and that is, and I always say this, but it's, in England, it's only Liverpool that's like this. In Scotland, there's a few places. You go to Scotland, Ireland. There's, you know, Glasgow's very like Liverpool.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I've always had this thing that there's always a tie up between dock cities.
Yeah.
So you've got Newcastle, you've got Glasgow, you've got Belfast, you've got Liverpool, and it's Liverpool. I don't know so much about the other cities, but Liverpool is a very matriarchal city. And then the docks and the, you know, ships coming in and out and the banter and there's something very, something they say about looking out, isn't it? There's something about when a city looks out to an ocean, to a sea, and it makes them more inviting sort of thing rather than being enclosed. And there's a definite link between those port cities. It's a really interesting thing. But Glasgow is exactly the same kind of place, you know. And all, interestingly, places that have all suffered, you know, at the hands of shitty governments and stuff. It's amazing, isn't it, that you think that...
Yeah, and I think, you know, exactly right. And Liverpool, you know, they were the city that kind of... People tried to divide down sectarian lines. I'm not saying it's not still there a little bit, but that it was the first place that went, no, they realised what they were doing, that they were trying to get them against each other rather than against the people who were really the trouble, which is everything. It's the Me Too movement, it's the Black Lives Matter, it's everyone going, look, it's them and not them at the top.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's the same sort of cycle all the time, and we're still falling for it. And I think it's more annoying when you're on the outside going, are you fucking stupid? This is quite clearly what's going on. And, you know, leaving school in the 80s, I was talking about this to my wife the other day. My eldest son graduated from Warwick University. And my only experience as an adult of university was when I took him 3 years ago for his open day. And university was not even a word that was used, certainly not in my household. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you can go to this place, this field of learning, and meet different people and meet different cultures and grow, you know, it's that thing from the apron strings to being a man or being a woman and being independent. Is that, I think university is really important for that, I think.
Yeah.
The idea that you have to pay for it is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
And the idea that kids are coming out of there with £50,000 worth of debt.
It's insane. You know, but that is insane. And I, you know, my generation, I went to university and it was, I think my parents had to make a little bit of a contribution, but it was basically free and no strings attached. And everything's sort of going that way a little bit, isn't it?
So, yeah. Well, it is, but they're talking about putting up to £9,000 a year, and then a lot of the modules are online, and you just think, what the fuck? My son graduated, but his paper wasn't properly marked because they were on strike. So we just said, just put first on it, that'll do it.
Oh, look. Thank you for talking about that and so eloquently and beautifully, and you know, it's an amazing thing. What have you got? With all this talk of your agent's not returning your calls?
She returns them, but just with really shit calls.
Have you got anything coming up that we...
I just want to say my agent's great, by the way.
Yeah. My agent's come in for a kicking in the last month, so you're going to be okay, not from me.
I've just forgotten this is podcast. I was having a chat with someone. I think, fuck, what have I said?
That's what we do here. That's what I do.
You've reeled me in, man. I'm in so much trouble now. Next time you watch The Crown, just look at the television in the background. I didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, they'll look and they'll see the actor who took the fucking role, that's the person who's going to be pissed off.
And he'll have my agent now. Yeah.
The stand-up you're such a great stand-up, and
thank you, man.
And you know, you do a lot here in Liverpool with the stand-up.
I only do that. I do Laughter House, which is. And we did last night. We did the Philharmonic, which is great. Yeah, it was good. You probably heard all this then. Sorry. I love it. It's that thing of like, you know, stand-up is such an incredible release, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm one of them people who just spend my week tutting and complaining. And of a Friday and Saturday night, I get to go out and go, you know what? And share my angst with people. And it's there's something wonderful about doing it, isn't it? Again, without avoiding the cliche. There's something wonderful about, especially when lockdown happened and it was a terrible time, wasn't it? And there was, you know, there were comedians going online and doing online comedy. I mean, I can't think of... I don't know whether you did it, Richard.
I did, but don't worry. But it,
fuck
but
me,
my comedy's not...
I'd rather shit me hand and clap, do you know what I mean? I couldn't imagine.
But I didn't really do stand-up. I didn't do stand-up. I don't think stand-up... You know, I did a couple of gigs and it was sort of okay, but it's nothing. It's not in any way the same as doing a stand-up.
It can't be anything worse than you're halfway through a gag and you just see someone standing up and walking off because the fucking camera's on them now. But when it came back, it was such an amazing thing to just see people again and people laughing and enjoying themselves. It's a great kind of, you get a lot back from it, don't you?
I think you do. It is all about spreading joy, right? And guys who the stand up guys just out there every week doing different stuff every week. It's often undervalued, and I think actually that job of going out there and making a room full of people who've had a shitty week and sometimes a really shitty week and just laugh for, you know, 2 hours and then it hasn't happened here. So go and see a proper comedy show. We've done all right. It's a cathartic thing for you as well. You know, I mentioned this the other day in another one, but I did Pappy's. A podcast with the Pappies thing, and they're so silly, the Pappies Fun Club guys. I don't know if you know them, but it's just silliness, and you hardly ever get that. And like, you're doing it and you're laughing, and the audience are laughing, and you just come out and go, you've laughed for 2 hours, and you just go, oh, fuck, you know, I was really tired before I went in there. I was thinking I wish I'd gone out, stayed at home.
It's the endorphins,
yeah, it's an amazing thing, just laughter.
And the fact that there isn't a lot to laugh about at the moment.
It is, but I think it's so necessary.
It really is necessary.
It's absolutely necessary, and it gets you through
absolutely
a little bit.
Absolutely it does, just for that little moment there. That's why it's so important. That's why I love doing it still. I don't need to do it.
Yeah.
I just love to do it. You know, I just love to kind of get out there. Let's keep match fit in it.
And
I love meeting the other comics and stuff like that. And it's great.
Oh man, look, it's such an honour to meet you, and thank you for talking so funnily about your career and so openly about those other aspects of your life. And I wish you very good luck. Not that you need it. I think things are going pretty well. But I'm a massive fan of your stuff. And ladies and gentlemen, please give up for Neil Fitzmaurice. Thanks so much for coming. Hope to see you again soon. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Neil Fitzmaurice. Thank you to Scant Regard, who do the music just for these credits, nowhere else. I'm indebted, of course, to Chris Evans, not that one or that one, and Ben Evans, not that one or that one, and thank you to George Lingford and George Ponsford as well. He's a good guy. Thank you to Bex Cliff. Thank you to everyone at the Liverpool Playhouse. Thank you to Avalon, their wonderful production company and management team, whatever Joe Lycett says about them. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk?
Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.